Okay, let's get started. We have a big day today, the midterm student presentations. Hope everybody's ready. Everybody should have an evaluation form. Everybody gets to evaluate the students. But you don't evaluate your own team. That would be unfair. I'll get another one. Please write legibly, because these are going to be distributed to the students so they can get some feedback on how well they did. For the students, I want to remind them that their midterm reports are due by email end of the day Tuesday. If you have any questions about anything, about the reports, you can talk to me, and there's a webpage that talks all about these reports. The presentations are going to be just 8 minutes each because of limited amount of time. So I want to tell you that maybe not all the details of the project will be presented because of the limited presentation time. So don't consider the presentation incomplete because of that. And we'll have just 2 questions per team. So make sure everybody has a form. Next Tuesday, we're going to be talking about robots, rehabilitation robots, and assistive robots. So that will be a lot of fun. And a week from today, I've organized an assistive technology fair. There'll be about 8 different vendors here presenting their stuff. We're going to set up tables outside the classroom. And you'll have a chance to go around to each table and check out all the products and devices and ask lots of questions. And there's even going to be a service dog here. So, you know, if you like dogs, you like robots too. Okay. So this is the schedule for these presentations today. And we'll start right off with ProApps. Come on down. Why isn't this working? Forward, and that's the laser pointer. And who wants the mic? No, you have to wear it on your belt and on your collar.
Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Kevin McCabe, and this is my partner, Bess Shields, and together we make up the team ProApps, which is short for Progressive Applications. And this quarter, we've named our project Discover Emotion, which will eventually be an iPad app that simulates a game that helps with the socio-development of students with autism.
For a little bit of background information on autism, autism is a developmental disorder. It's usually detected within the first 3 years of life, and it affects students' abilities in social and communication skills. Now, there's about 1 in 88 children affected by autism, and we've been working in particular with PACE, which is the Pacific Autism Center for Education. They serve about 60 students all across the autism spectrum, but they do have a large number of students on the more severe end of the autism spectrum.
So when looking at this project, one of the challenges is the concept of social processing. And that can best be broken down into three steps, and maybe best explained by a very simple example. So say I see Beth walking down the street, and I see that she has a sad face. That's the first step, is recognizing that emotion. That's followed by the second step, which is internalizing that feeling within myself. I internalize it as sad. And finally, the third step is to respond to that emotion and that internalization in an appropriate manner. And so one of the problems that we're trying to address is the fact that students with autism have trouble with these socio-emotional cues, and especially in discerning between emotions on different facial expressions. And we feel that this is a very valuable skill because studies have shown that early assistants with these socio-emotional cues tend to have a positive impact on the behavioral development of students.
So for our approach, we wanted to look in particular at that first step of social processing, recognizing emotions based on facial cues. And we want to design a game around that. And then we talked about some customizable features that we could add into that game in order to connect it with the other steps of social processing. So one of the things in particular that we talked about was the idea of adding in familiar faces. So instead of just, you know, taking pictures of people that you don't know, adding in some familiar faces like of a parent or a caregiver. So if you get used to recognizing certain emotions and the way that person expresses it, it's easier to translate it to real-life situations.
So looking at where we've been and how we got to where we are today, one of the first interviews we did was with two former students to this class, actually, Anna and Han Lee. They created two apps. Actually, one was an iPad app called Emotionary. The other was a series of mini-games for the Xbox Kinect called Mimu. In that interview, early on in the quarter, they emphasized the importance of adding a sense of realism to our app, and also mentioned that the possibility for a connection for our game to their app, Emotionary, which is a journal or diary of emotions, could have a pretty big impact for students who are looking for more of a context to the emotions that they're feeling on a day-to-day basis.
So next we went down to Pace, and we interviewed Kurt, who is the director there. And he told us about a bunch of the apps that they have experience with. And he said most of them primarily focus on communication rather than on emotional recognition. He also helped us out with just some general ease-of-use features for the students working with the iPad. And then he and the other therapist there particularly emphasized not only the realism necessary in the app, but also the need for flexibility and customization within the app. A lot of times they'll have a particular student and they find an application that's perfect for that student's needs, and that student will go and use that application for a while, but when they get to the next student, that student will have sort of a different set of needs. And a lot of the apps aren't very customizable, so they will have to go and find an entirely different game for the next student, which, as you can imagine, is a lot of extra work. And also, you know, the aides have to learn a whole other game that they're helping the students with.
So in addition to these interviews, we've done a little bit of research on our own, looking at some of the existing solutions that are out there. We've primarily encountered iPad apps and interactive DVDs. But in this research, we noticed a few problems with these. One of them being the fact that they focus on mainly one category of those three social processing steps that we talked about. There's really no attention given to either more than one of the steps, and especially no attention given to helping the transition between steps. We also noticed that there's not a lot of availability for customization, which is something that Beth alluded to as being very important for us. They really only offer a stock product that's meant to reach out to as many people as possible, but no customization readily available. And a big factor for a lot of people, too, is the cost. We've noticed that a lot of these run upwards of $150 for these sets of DVDs, obviously a big factor for students and parents alike.
So moving on to our design, we decided that we wanted to do a picture matching game. And this is a picture of our basic prototype up on the left. The top row has a word for an emotion. This one's surprise. And then it has a picture with someone giving an example of that emotion. And then the students have two photos on the bottom, and they want to choose or tap the person expressing the same emotion that's listed above. And we wanted the example picture to try to have them highlight, you know, common facial features and also work with real people instead of icons. And then we brainstormed a whole set of customizable features that we could add in, the biggest one of which that we want to focus on is, again, that idea of adding in familiar faces. So if you can take a picture of your mom making a happy face and have that appear throughout the game as well.
So looking at the construction of this prototype, which is up there, we chose a set of six emotions as the base for our game. As you can see, we're able to coerce some of our friends into making these facial expressions for us. They're pretty tough to do, actually. And here you can see our finished prototype, which is just a paper prototype on foam core. It highlights a few of the things that Beth talked about, such as the matching of an emotion and a picture between rows, and of course our feedback mechanism, which is the lights for a correct answer.
So next we took our prototype down to PACE and worked with some of the students there. These are three of the students that we worked with, and they do represent a range on the spectrum of autism. And so we were able to work with these students, see how they liked the game, get their feedback about how it was to use and how much they liked it. And we also worked with some of the speech therapists and occupational therapists there, who again emphasized the need for customizability. And we also pitched to them the idea of adding in familiar faces, and they said that's not something that they had encountered before, and they do agree that it would help.
So here's just a quick clip of one of the interactions that we had with a student, Rolando, at PACE.
Okay.
Actually, it's not going to happen.
Okay. Well,
but some of the highlights from that is, as you can see, there's the emotion in words up on the top left and the picture that corresponds to that on the top right. And the task was to match both the emotion and the picture to the correct emotion on the second row. One of the highlights about this particular run is that sad was paired with confused, which is kind of a tough thing. And the clip would have shown him, you know, kind of struggling between them and trying to match up the picture between the two below. But he eventually got it right. And the video would have helped us with this slide, which is going forward, we want to continue these meetings with students and therapists from PACE to try and gather as much feedback as possible, especially when we have our actual app coded. It'll help us test and debug a lot of the features that we implement. And, of course, our main concern right now is just to code the app itself in hopes that one day we release it to the App Store and provide a tool for as many people as possible.
And let me set some thank yous and links.
Thank you.
We'll have two questions.
All right.
If there are two questions.
What are you going to do about the actual coding method? Are you going to do that yourself?
Yes.
Somebody else to do that?
Yeah, we'll be done by
that.
We're getting it. Yeah. Brushing up on it. It's new to us, but we're getting it.
Anybody else? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The design concepts that we came up with and their analysis, and then what work we want to do in the future. So our problem statement was to create a device that enables a child with upper limb amputation to do the monkey bars. So the first thing that we did is we went on YouTube and watched many, many videos of kids doing the monkey bars. And so I found two videos in particular that demonstrated diversity of kids doing monkey bars. So two hands on the monkey bars, one hand swinging fast, swinging slow. And so here are two short clips.
Go play.
All the way across.
Maybe. Hopefully.
All the way across.
So one thing we notice is that with both kids, their legs are flailing. With this girl, she sometimes is just doing one hand at a time, and sometimes she has both hands, and then progresses one, and then two, and then one and two. And then the second girl, she does the monkey bars really, really quickly, with just one hand at a time, and occasionally swinging between monkey bars and skipping bars, so she has a longer stride length, which is something that's important to note. And she sometimes also flips her arm backwards when she turns around. So after we looked at that, we went and we talked with Gary Burke, who's a prosthetist in Redwood City. And so the things that he told us that prostheses are designed to withstand compressive loads really well. So you can push your arm inside them really well, and it'll feel comfortable, and it'll still fit, and it won't fall off. The thing is that when you pull away, when you put it in tension, there's only so much load it can carry. So you can lift weights, and you can do other small forces, but you can't have your arms above your head without falling out. It won't hold you up. We also asked him which of his patients want to do the monkey bars, because we want to know our demographic. And he said it's usually kids between the ages of 6 and 9 who want to do this, and then after age 9 they grow out of it. And so we haven't yet been able to talk with any kids or parents. Gary's currently trying to organize that for us. But a few of the questions that we're interested in is how much does the cosmesis and cool matter to the child? So it's a question of function over form. So if we create a product that's completely functional, like how much does it have to be cool for them to use it? Could it be completely functional and they'll still use it, or will they just not use it at all if it doesn't look like the coolest toy they've ever had? Also, when will the device be used? Something they want to throw on quickly at recess? They want to have it with them at all times? So basically, what setting and how quickly does it have to be able to be put on and off? And lastly, for the parents, we wanted to ask them if they would even let their child use the device, because it's something that could be kind of dangerous. Parents are afraid when their kids go on the jungle gym normally, so it's another hurdle if parents don't feel comfortable with such a device. And so we modified our need statement, thinking of kids' interests, to be a child with upper limb amputation needs to be able to keep up with his or her friends during jungle gym play on the monkey bars. And we asked Gary, are there any existing solutions? And he said, none. There aren't any. So instead, we looked at related solutions to problems. So we looked at in different situations, how are people being held up? So in sailing and construction, rock climbing, how is the load distributed to keep up? And so we looked at harnesses, because that's usually the solution to these problems. And they do usually have shoulder or mid-body harnesses, but most of the load is held in the legs. Also, we looked at sports prostheses and weight-bearing hooks, because while they don't hold an enormous amount of load, they do withstand a lot of use and abuse, and they do stay together. So we wanted to see how people design prostheses to be durable.
So we brainstormed a number of different ideas, and they came in basically three different classes of notions. The first is change the environment, change something about the jungle gym or the place of which they work. And maybe that'll make it easier for a user to get across the monkey bars. The second, introduce a whole new kind of prosthesis, something that will be able to bear the load in a way that existing prostheses don't. The third, which we didn't think was possible at first, was just do a new end effector, just something you can snap into an existing prosthesis and go from there. Here's one example of one of the first classes of ideas. Let's say that the user or a user's parent would just set up a series of boxes along the track of the monkey bars. The user would use his or her one good hand and swing and then step and then swing and then step. Kind of a different motion, but still, you'd be able to use the same equipment that everybody uses. Here's a notion from the second category of ideas, in which we add on a whole new prosthesis. This would require a harness, like those we talked about, three different kinds, depending on how you need to move the forces, what you need to connect to up above. The general idea is that strapping would be connected to the end effector that would then connect to a harness that helps bear the load. So the prosthesis itself would just be used to target, locate, and then wait for transfer down into the body. Now we compared a number of the different ideas this goes off the charts. The end conclusion, well, just to tell you, of the five points of comparison we show on the right are those that Gary Burke talked about in his lecture to us last Thursday, the most important points for amputees using prostheses, the comfort, cosmesis, function, cost, and coolness factors. Now, what we found was we were really getting pointed in a direction that we didn't at first think was possible, towards the add-on end effect that comes up totals to 20, everything else the closest is 18. But how do you do that? Well, we needed to figure out a new way to use the body in this motion. Every time you've ever seen someone get on the monkey bars, he's in this posture. You know, he's got both arms above his head. Now, that's exactly the wrong loading condition for the prosthesis. But you don't necessarily need to have that. Let's rethink it. Let's position the partial arm in a different way and just give you the end effector of the bust. And here's one possible solution for how to do that. Now you've got a hook pointed down, and you can load your partial arm, and the end effector is still up where it needs to be. And here's an example of what that might look like. This is kind of some fake-out CAD. It's still rough and unrefined. We played around a lot and manufactured a couple of our own harnesses testing that idea beforehand, kind of getting a little depressed because it was such a pain to put the thing on. But now, finally, with this notion, okay, connect something to an existing prosthesis that reaches up to another end effector. Now, we finally got something that we can say, yeah, that might work. So, for future work, we really need to interview more people, including potential users and parents of potential users. We need to prototype the exact nature of the connection between the end effector and existing prostheses. And we need to prototype and refine that hook geometry and what kind of grip, actuated or not actuated, it needs to be. Hard time. Special thanks to Gary Burke, and here's our resources. Any questions?
I was just wondering, it's going to be a little bit weird, you know, not having the arm with the hook, pointed down.
True. Very true.
But, you know, it does provide a better way of providing support.
One notion we have with this, we're still working on the dynamics of the situation. One thing that's weird about this is in order for this end effector to go forward, you need to move your arm backwards. So there's a little non-intuitiveness about that, but then we're speaking as an able-bodied user, a child with an amputation, maybe it's never happened. So either we can change the device so that move your arm forward and the hook goes forward. There's another a number of possibilities we'll work out.
Anybody else?
Did you ever ask any people, amputees, whether doing the monkey bars is something they want to do?
So we haven't yet been able to talk to anybody who has an amputated arm, but this is the project was proposed by Gary Burke, who's a prosthetist, who said he's had many kids who've come into his office saying, I'm going to do the monkey bars, I'm going to do the monkey bars, and every time they ask, he'll say, you can't, just wait, like, you can't do this quite yet, and they have to outgrow it.
I think he said it was like every kid in that certain age range that he's talked to has brought up monkey bars at one point or another. So.
But they can't do it, so...
This is forward, and that's a laser pointer. And, I think she's going to. Okay, you have a place to put it?
No.
So we asked Gary Burke, who's a professor. empathetic depiction, what was the biggest difficulty he's addressing? And so what he mentioned was buttoning his shirt, because, you know, oftentimes you would need two hands to button a shirt as opposed to just having one. And he also mentioned some considerations for developing a buttoning dress aid for a person with an upper limb amputation. For example, he mentioned portability, a device where they can carry it on themselves.
Basically, we break down the task of buttoning into three different types. Buttoning the shirt, buttoning the cuffs, and buttoning jeans. Now, differences of these different tasks require different difficulties and motions while buttoning. For shirts, there's many of them on a single shirt, which takes up a lot of time. So you need to be very quick to button them all. Cuff buttons require you to button without the use of a hand. And jean buttons require you to button while fighting tension across the jeans. There are many existing aids out there that try to tackle the issues of buttoning, but they do not adequately address all the issues of a person's needs when buttoning. This one seems to be easy to use for shirt buttons, however it cannot be used for cuffs and jeans, because the wire on itself easily bends and actually breaks quite often. And it is actually quite bulky to carry around. They have a magic button aid, which claims to be good for jeans. However, it requires the person to have the buttons already on top of each other and cannot be used if there was more tension on the jeans. The pocket dresser is very versatile and quite popular. However, the main complaint that many of the users have is that it's too big and too bulky to be carried on in the pocket at all times. And that's when you redress throughout the day, you might not have it on you, and it becomes more difficult. There are also more permanent solutions, such as Velcro and other adaptive clothing. Now, this requires either you to modify all your clothing by someone else, or you need to buy from a more limited and expensive selection of clothing for the adaptive clothing. Velcro is also very easily dirtied. It is, and it also cannot hold if the tension is too large. So the overall disadvantages of many of these existing aids is that they do not address the buttoning of cuffs nor the jeans, and they do not achieve true portability for the user.
So this is just some criteria for designing our buttoning aid. Function, portability, aesthetic, so something that doesn't really look like a medical device, as well as cost, so something that could be affordable. And so this was one of Nate's designs very early in the class, and it's something he just made for a couple of cents with a 3D printer. Some of the pros is that it's really cheap, it's functional, but at the same time, it may be too difficult to use because it's so small. One of the pros of this, though, was the fact that we learned how to button with one hand, and it gave us some insight on the mechanism for doing so. This is one of our second designs. It's also a button hook, like Poutine said. The whole premise is that you can use it for any diameter button by adjusting the cord, and you just loop the other one through the button hook, and it releases the tension between the two sides of the jeans. Some of the cons that may be difficult to use, we still need to prototype it for functionality and material.
So the cufflink button, it is more difficult because you cannot actually use a tool to button your cufflink, to cuff button, since you don't have the use of your hand. So it is easier to change the button altogether. So what we did was we changed it into either a magnetic or a snap-on button. You just take a simple cufflink that has a magnet on one side. While it is off your shirt, you can place it through the buttonhole and pin the other side to the cuff. If you bring them close enough together, they will snap together. And throughout the day, you can take it apart and put it back together with ease without needing a tool or another hand. Now, the differences between magnetic and snap is one is much, much easier to use. The magnet, it comes together very easily. Snap requires you to find maybe a hard surface, and it's harder to get it together. However, there's dangers that evolve with a magnet. Say you're afraid it might get magnetize your like watch or your credit card or something like that. However, this whole thing is very, very cheap to use. It can be made with aluminum. Magnets would be the most expensive thing on here. And the task is actually quite simple. It is as easy as putting on a normal person putting on the cufflink before you put on your shirt. So the future designs for this is we need to make sure that this thing is small, concealable, and comfortable for the person to wear, and that it is very easy to use and very easy to put on your shirt at all times. We're going to continue testing this on people who have this affliction and ask others to try to test our equipment while using only a single hand. And we're done. Thank you. Yes?
Have you talked to the folks at the Veterans Administration about what they're finding in the way of needs for amputees and suggestions that they might have?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the last part.
And suggestions have you been able to talk to the folks at the VA to get their thoughts on the best way to solve this problem?
We have not been able to discuss with them yet. We are planning on discussing with people who actually do have this issue. We mostly have been talking with Gary and Megan, who deal with unilateral transradial amputees all the time. They did say cufflinks is one, and jean buttons are the main problems when buttoning. For jeans, a lot of the times they solve it by like lying on a bed so that they can decrease the tension while buttoning the jeans. However, say if you're going to the bathroom, you don't have a bed to lie on to redo this process. So we figure a dressing aid is more appropriate to solve this kind of problem.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice. So we'll look into that. I'm going to try to get contact with the VA.
Any other questions? It's not attached to the belt. It's the loop is attached to the button, and then it's fed through the hole of the pants, and then you just pull it out such that like the button will come back out through the hole, and then you can slip the rest of it into your belt loop. And yeah.
So you can cover it with a belt. So that's one of our ideas of portability. So you don't have to just keep it in a pocket. You keep it on there.
And you can use it whenever. Yes? What about GPS then? I'm an amputee and I travel a lot. I need it on my person. What's the solution there? When I saw the thing that looked like a Swiss Army knife, I thought, oh, there's no way that's on GPS. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's also one of the reasons why we don't think it's that viable of a solution. Most of our solutions, we're hoping it will be easily concealable on the person. It'll be something that the TSA will definitely not have to double check again, because all these tools, they like inside X-rays, they look like knives more or less. So anything that's made of cloth or a simple aluminum round, that'd be better for our product.
Okay.
Sorry.
Good afternoon. My name is Kenya Alfred. I am a team of one today, and my product is my inhaler, and it is an inhaler adornment project. So to give you an outline of the presentation, I'll talk about the context of the problem. We'll look at the insights I gained from my interviewees. I'll talk about the need, the exact need that I'm going to be addressing. I'll look at the existing market. I will show you my design concept, talk about what I'd like to do moving forward, and then conclude. So the context of the problem, what are we dealing with? We're dealing with asthma. It's a common respiratory illness. Most people either know someone who has it, if you don't necessarily have it yourself. And it technically is an inflammatory disease of the lungs, airways, that causes them to swell and narrow, which leads to hardness in breathing, wheezing, coughing, and chest tightness. So there are many ways to treat asthma. There are pills or inhalers. But before we go to that, let's look at some facts. So it can be triggered by allergy-causing substances such as pollen, or it can be exercise-induced, or actually viruses or illnesses can just lead to an asthma attack if you already have it. 1 in 11 children has asthma, and 1 in 12 adults has asthma, according to the CDC. And as I said, though it can be treated, it is still deadly, and it is still something that needs to be taken, measures need to be taken to treat it appropriately, because approximately 9% die of asthma every day, which was a number I didn't know, and that shows me that it's real and it's a serious problem that needs to be addressed. So as I said, people can take pills, or most people use inhalers. So there are three main types of inhalers. There's a metered dose inhaler, which is the common puff one, which most people have. There's also a dry powder inhaler, which, as opposed to the metered dose inhaler where you press the canister and then that vaporizes and you breathe that directly into your lungs, there's the dry powder inhaler where you breathe it in, and in breathing it in, that activates the dry dust, and then you get in, you ingest it or you breathe it in your airways. And then there are also nebulizers, which is the diagram on your right, which has the sort of box-like device which vaporizes the medication, and then there's a mouthpiece where you breathe it in. So I'm going to be talking more about metered dose inhalers, because the idea of the problem, or what I'm trying to address is, You need an inhaler because you have asthma. You want to have it around, but I wanted to see what the space was around inhalers and see if there's something about lowering the stigma that's associated with it. Are there other problems that are associated with inhalers that you just don't know about? So that led to my talking to users. There are two big categories in my user interviews. I spoke to children less than 12 and their parents, and then I spoke to users who are greater than 12 or older than 12. And there are specific things that each group sort of put more emphasis on, but there are lots of commonalities which were interesting, and these are they. Okay. So one of the big things that came up was knowing how much medication is left. Because you have the inhaler, you probably have it for a couple months or 2 years, and you're not sure how many puffs you've taken. And that can be bad when you're having an asthma attack and you need 2 puffs, but you only have enough for one. What do you do then? So keeping track of the number of puffs was important. Convenience was also something that came up, especially for the older users. I spoke to a 12-year-old, I spoke to a 15-year-old. So they have it in their backpack, they have it in their locker gym. But where exactly did they put it? When they put it, how does it look? They're rumbling around in their bags looking for the inhaler, so they wanted it to be handy, they wanted it to be easily available. And they wanted to have somewhere that they knew it was. This is where I put it, this is the case, this is where it is. Another thing that came up was appearance, which was interesting because for the 12-year-olds and the 15-year-olds, they didn't necessarily want an action figure or pink teddy bears or something like that because they're sort of too old for that. So they still wanted it to be easily identifiable. So that was one thing that came up. So that parents, in terms of action figures and things like that, seemed more important for younger users. But then sort of bridging the spectrum and going to someone who's about like mid-20s or a young adult, a parent came up, but not necessarily in "I need something cool," but just something to lower the negative connotations associated with inhalers. You know, it sort of reminds you of that time when you were in middle school and you had that bad attack, and you don't necessarily want to associate that with inhalers. So appearance was important in the sense of it being convenient and easy to reach, but not so stigmatizing and not something that, oh, I have an inhaler, look at me here. And then all the things that came up were like educational components about it for the parents in understanding what your child's situation is and how do you treat that well, and then for children, how exactly do I use my inhaler? And an independent factor for younger users was also an insight that I gained. So moving forward, I decided to focus on knowing how much medication was left, on the convenience factor, having it be readily identifiable and easier to find, and also appearance. So this is my defined need, that stakeholders need a reusable inhaler pacing that keeps track of the number of puffs left while ensuring that the inhaler is handy and can be easily identified. And I spoke about most of these things, but the reusable part came up because for one user, you're going to use a number of inhalers over the course of your life, and I thought it would be easy to have one casing as opposed to buying a new inhaler and having to like go around the whole cycle again. So this is the existing market in terms of things that are used to adorn inhalers. There are a range of items. I like especially the console one here, where you can keep track of the amount of puffs that you have left. One thing I don't like as much about it is that it seems specific to one inhaler, which is against the reusable aspect that I'm trying to go for. Then you have the puffs, which is the sort of like stickers put on inhalers, which in itself it addresses a certain need, but I wanted the material itself to be something that was more durable. And then you have these sort of woolen cases or cloth-stitched cases, which I like that there are the keychains there, so you can clip it on and it's easier to access. But one thing I didn't like was that it covered the mouthpiece itself, so it was like a two-step process you had to do when you're using the inhaler. I wanted it to be a one-step process. So moving forward, this is a summary of some of my design concepts. I played around with having a retractable keyring. I was looking at two types of counter mechanisms, whether an analog or mechanical one versus a digital or electronic one. Thanks to Lecker Murphy from PRL, he helped me to brainstorm. In terms of the casing, should it be a harder plastic or softer plastic? Should it be cut laterally and be able to be enclosed? Can you just like put it over like a sleeve? These are some of the ideas I thought about. So moving forward, I liked the electronic display. I liked it being a one-part casing just to put it over. It's not supposed to be hard to do. It's not supposed to be something that you have to try and remember to do in the mornings or whenever you're using the inhaler. So this is a prototype of my design. This was made of the Play-Doh, but the idea is to have a silicone mold be the casing and to incorporate an electronic counter display in that. It's a one-piece casing, so you buy the inhaler and it already has its cap, it already has its structure, and you just put the casing over. And then when you finish that inhaler, you move on to the next one and you can put that casing on. It's bright orange because I was speaking to one of my users and she said, I really just want it to be bright orange. I just want to be able to find it, I need to be able to see it, I'm not into pink teddy bears, just something that I can find easily. So I like that idea, so I prototyped that. And I have a keychain, which is supposed to be something to help. A lot of lights are just helping it be more accessible. So moving forward, I need to choose my counter mechanism besides something mechanical or electronic, create a CAD model to move on and create a silicone mold, and also interview users again to get feedback on my prototype. That's the following people, and these are my references. Thank you. I haven't, so this will be okay.
Yeah.
And then we have resources at the PRL, so that's one thing we're excited about. Yeah.
There's going to be a choice of colors and patterns.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
always important because people want to have a choice. Anything else?
The people you talk to, it sounds like more people are looking for something that is flashy and something they can really identify very quickly, or something that is more subtle. What's the trend?
Actually, the trend is more, I guess, I'd say it's the latter, where they don't need to be defined by their inhaler necessarily, but because they have used it all the time, they want something that they're not necessarily embarrassed by. So the general idea I got, it's like, for me, it's like lip balm. I don't need to be defined by my lip balm, but I want it to be readily available. It's there. It needs to be handy. It needs to have a defined taste. So that was the general trend I was getting in terms of inhalers.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
Sean Pacheco, I'm a senior ME student here, and I'm the sole member of Team 2 Clean. I'll also put up Molly Hale here because she's been a huge contributor to the design process so far. I'm actually making the 2 Clean for her. So let's start off by talking about Molly a little bit. I think she's a superstar. I think she's a very inspirational person. And has come up with a pretty good product idea. She's a very active person. She does karate. She does horseback riding, and she is outside a lot. And because of that, she gets a lot of dirt and grime and horse manure on her wheels. And she has talked to many people and said they kind of have the same problem and said that this scope could probably be pretty large. So again, the problem with dirt on the wheels, she had a different problem in that she was really dealing with a lot of manure, a lot of really kind of grimy, heavy stuff that was kind of hard to get off. And the way she was going about it was kind of just by spraying down her wheels by hand with a hose. Which was okay. It was a little difficult for her, as you can imagine, from sitting in a chair to get to that angle, and also it was almost impossible for her to get the inside of the wheels because she's sitting in the wheelchair. And again, she said that this is something that many wheelchair users need to deal with, and there's not a lot on the market right now that kind of tries to attack this problem. So I started with some background research and found two main kind of things out there right now. The first one was this guy up here, which is kind of used more in hospitals, and it's kind of aimed more towards like bacterial disinfection, and it's basically just almost like a dishwasher for wheelchairs. So this is good for it's used more for manual wheelchairs, not electric. But Molly definitely wanted to be in her wheelchair while she did it. She wanted to be something that was outside of her door. You could just roll up and go in. She'd have to either get out or this really wouldn't be something that she could use. Then I found this no-tracks wheelchair wheel cleaner here, which is pretty good. It's actually very close to the initial design I had in my head, with a few kind of big problems there that kind of doesn't lend itself to Molly's actual situation. First of all, it's this little jug of water here is about this big, and in the video they have on their website, you have to fill out the jug before you use it from a sink. Take the jug over to this little black box here and spin it over and put it down before all the water spills out. And I feel like that's definitely hard, especially if you're in a chair, to do all that every time. And this only carried about one or two uses, so you'd be having to do that all the time. It was kind of seemed like a time-consuming, hard task. On top of that, because it's only this much water, and it's just coming out of there, you're not really getting like a good cleaning power. It's just it's a very small amount, and it's not really going to attack the big horse manure and tough dirt that Molly kind of expressed that she usually got. And finally, Well, one of the things that Molly really expressed is that there's no waste catching system. The waste is going to fall right onto the ground wherever she is, and if she's going to put it in her yard or somewhere that's going to go into her house, she doesn't want just that big build up of horse manure and dirt and grime. Then finally, I moved my research to kind of the industrial uses. I don't know if you can see it, it's kind of a little blurry, but this is used on like construction sites for rigs or trailers or anything. And it basically just sprays from all angles the trucks. It was pretty cool to watch the videos of these where they just come running through and water's flying everywhere. So here's some of my early designs. Very early on, I figured that the way to clean the wheel the best is to have it spin and have a brush or whatever you're going to use to clean it kind of stay stationary. So I started with kind of a lifting mechanism like you'd see on like a jack for a car. That would lift up the car and allow both wheels to spin. I quickly found out through talking with Molly that at least for hers and for many others is a one axle drive. Hers is driven from the center wheels. So this wouldn't necessarily work. I was just unaware that just one wheel spun and this one would just be sitting there, not doing anything. My next one was kind of a ratchet arm here. It was kind of a shot out of left field. It was kind of, I was trying to attack the idea of when the water would turn on. I thought this could be good with a kind of an on-off valve where it would be like the race in the cartoons where you'd run over the front and it would like shoot up and kind of hit your wheel and start washing it. That was quickly kind of put away because it seemed like a lot of mechanical parts that you didn't really need. I then moved to a top and side kind of jet washer, very close to what you saw with the industrial washer. This was okay. It had the waste, but it didn't get the inside of the wheel there, which was like a very hard selling point that Molly made that she wanted on her final product. And then one of my last design things I found was rollers. The concept of rollers that could lock and unlock so that you could have the rollers locked, drive up, situate your chair on the rollers, then unlock the rollers, and instead of having a jack that lifts your chair up so your wheels can spin, your wheels can just free spin on this roller while jet or brusher or whatever it is cleaning your wheels, and then lock them back up and then roll away. So with the research, kind of what Molly said, and the early design, I kind of came up with these kind of things that we want to see in the solution, wanted more cleaning power for kind of the dirt, the extra dirt she sees. We wanted both the inside and the outside of the wheels to be clean. We wanted an easy waste removal that she made clear that she wanted to be able to remove it herself even from the chair, or also have it able to have someone else use it. She even brought up using it at a place that she goes for to do water therapy where they could get a volunteer to clean it and wouldn't necessarily have to have someone in a wheelchair. She wanted hands-free, and my contribution to this was I wanted it to be simple. I feel like it's a very simple problem. It's a very mechanical problem. I didn't want any electrical or anything else that wasn't mechanical. I wanted it to be very durable, something that you can leave outside and withstand rain and the water that it's going to have itself. So this kind of a couple of drawings of my initial design. I kind of went with this roll-on idea that you saw in my initial designs where user will roll up. It has the rollers that lock and unlock. Hers is set in the center because of the center wheel drive. It's got a good space here where we have jets shooting from either side of the wheel out of these walls here. And so to take care of the smaller wheels on the front and back of hers and a big wheel kind of in the center. So the center wheel would ride on there and free spin and have the jet hit it as it spun. The smaller wheels, because they're so small in diameter, will have plenty of time to spin 2, 3, 4 times before they get to the end. So by having jets constantly spinning while you're going on and off, you'll get many rotations of the smaller wheel where you might only get one or two of the big one, and that's why you need the rollers. Also, you'll have the waste little boxes here. I'm sorry, I neglected to put a drawing of that. But basically, you can picture almost like a shoebox there with an open top, and on one side, there's a wheel on an axle, which makes it sit kind of crooked, makes it sit at an angle, which you can see here is the part that would be sitting down. And I thought there's a hole that the water will fall through these little grates here, collect in the waste, and then we'll have some sort of filter that will just take out really the big particles, letting the rest of the water just flow out. And I spoke close to her, kind of saying, "Well, do you really want all this, you know, manure, muddy water all over your thing?" And she seemed fine with it. She said it wasn't a big deal. And that's kind of what she has going now, that she leaves everything there. So she was just kind of happy to have the large stuff being taken away. And then these, because they're on wheels, can be rolled out. I'm probably planning on putting kind of rope or something on there, be rolled out and taken to the curb or the garbage or wherever you're going to dispose of the hard waste. Coming up next, I'm working on the actual mechanism to stop the rotation of the wheels, and I'm thinking of an arm like this. I modeled this arm kind of after the lover she uses on her wheelchair. I wanted something very simple that you could just kind of apply force this way to this way. It would be locked. Kind of this is the rotating shaft that these guys ride on, and so here it would be on if it would rotate, and once you move this lever, it would then be free to rotate. You could just pull it back and lock it. I need to work on the actual jets. I'm thinking PVC and kind of having water come in. I want to make sure that the pressure is going to be high enough though that it's going to actually do something when it cleans it. I don't want it to kind of trickle out, so there'll be some water flow calculations with that. Yeah, I hope to fabricate it, and probably out of wood or something like that that's kind of easier to work with, and have her try it and really move on it. And then with that, if need be, after the initial test, I was thinking brushes, which would go just alongside here to add on to the jets, but that would be kind of on a need basis. I'm a little worried about those kind of getting stuff caught on them, and then you have to watch that as well. Now I can open up to any questions. I'm hoping to, yeah, I haven't done the calculations yet, but I'm hoping to use a water hose as the input, and I can change the number of outputs or the sizing of the tube I'm going to use to kind of get the right pressure ratio. I was thinking about looking into those spring goes to move back and forth. I feel that comes with a water hose, and they get a pretty good distance.
I think one of the exciting things about what you're trying to do is that there's a lot of people who share the same thing. And so they were talking to me all the time that I had never really thought about the fact that when I go home, I take my shoes off and usually pat around in my socks because I don't particularly want to crack in anything. Of course, everybody who's in a wheelchair drives into their home, especially if they got Parkinson's. You can't imagine how difficult it is. I think you identified that for a nice problem. I'm sure this is a problem from before plastic and such. So I look forward to seeing, you know, whatever mock-up you come up with. All I can say is I think this is something really interesting.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Presentations we've seen so far.
My topic is Reawaken, which is a very tentative title, so if anything strikes you while I'm presenting, I need help with that, so please let me know. My name is Andrew Logan. I'm a junior. I'm majoring in human biology and pursuing a minor in mechanical engineering, and for this project I'm collaborating with a company called NeuroSky. So
Today I want to talk to you a little about the revolutionary technology that NeuroSense has produced. I want to talk to you about a problem that I think it can do a really good job of addressing. I have a personal connection with that problem that I want to explore and tell you why I got interested in it. I'm going to talk a little about the brainstorming and design of the device that I think can help individuals with this problem. And then I'm going to talk about my work plan and my plan over the next several weeks. So on the day when we had the presenters come in, the project that appealed to me the most was NeuroSky portable EEG devices. I had recently watched a viral video about a woman using a similar brain-computer interface device to control a robotic arm that she then used to drink from the cup. And this woman was a tetraplegic woman who had, you know, not had control of her arms in multiple years. And watching, you know, the success and the fist pump when she was able to do that was really inspiring to me, and I really wanted to sort of explore this technology further. And for those of you that don't know, EEG stands for electroencephalography, and EEG measures the electrical activity of the brain. So estimates right now say that the human brain has about 100 billion neurons, which is an extraordinary number and a really difficult number for me at least to wrap my mind around. And every interaction between neurons creates a small, minuscule electrical discharge that's relatively hard to measure. However, dominant brain states, where we have hundreds of thousands of neurons doing similar types of activity, are very easy to measure and relatively simple to interpret. And so these different interactions between neurons, different patterns of neural interaction, lead to different brain states. So, for example, when you're sitting down to do your homework and you want to concentrate, we often see brain waves associated, you know, that between hertz of 12 and 30 and beta waves. When we're sitting down after work and we're calming down, it's more associated with brain waves between 8 and 12 hertz and alpha waves. And so after getting myself a little familiarized with this technology, I wanted to think about what I could connect it to. And the first thing that came to mind was I wanted to use it biofeedback for stroke rehabilitation patients. And I also thought about using it to automate certain tasks around the house, like turning on your lights or turning off your lights. And then I decided, due to feasibility and interest, that I would apply the topic to narcoleptic people. And so, for those of you that don't know, narcolepsy is a chronic, lifelong condition characterized by extreme drowsiness, sudden bouts of sleep, sleep paralysis, dreamlike hallucinations, and cataplexy. So at any point during the day, an individual with narcolepsy can suffer a sudden irresistible bout of sleep where they have to sleep, and that can last anywhere from several minutes to several hours. And so while it's not a deadly condition, per se, I'm sure you can imagine that it would be extremely dangerous if you were driving a car, operating machinery, or even just climbing up the stairs and had a sudden bout of sleep that you couldn't resist. And so, due to, you know, stigma with invisible diseases and mental health, narcolepsy is often completely underdiagnosed, but conservative estimates say that about 1 in every 2,000 individuals suffers from narcolepsy. Just going through the symptoms again, it's extreme drowsiness, sleep attacks, which just means you fall asleep immediately. Dreamlike hallucinations are states where you don't know if you're awake or you're asleep. Sleep paralysis is a state of waking up and still being arrested in your body. Like you're awake, you're conscious, you just can't move. And cataplexy is a sudden muscle weakness that occurs and is typically triggered by a strong emotion. So I also have a personal connection to the problem. And the really cute kid all the way on the your left is one of my best friends growing up, Omar McKenzie. And Omar has lived with me, we've gone to school together for 13 years, and he's off at Yale right now. So about 3 months into his Yale experience, Omar started having troubles concentrating in class, he was falling asleep in class, and his grades and his social life subsequently suffered. Over this time period, he had no idea what was going wrong with him. It took about 6 months between his doctors and his physicians found out that he struggled from narcolepsy. And once they diagnosed it, there's ways to adjust your lifestyle to handle it better. And now he's doing successfully at Yale. But, you know, sort of his success and his fear about not being able to be a surgeon at one point are really things that made me want to look into narcolepsy further and explore it. Another huge problem with narcolepsy is the socioeconomic impact. About 3/4 of individuals with narcolepsy, you know, say that at one time they've fallen asleep behind the wheel, and 56% say that, you know, they've nearly been in an accident because of this. You know, other problems involve scraping yourself, burning yourself, falling asleep, and breaking items. And, you know, a Danish study estimated that about 12,000 euros a year is the overall social and health cost of having narcolepsy. And that's a lot of money, you know, for anybody. At the moment, there's no way to prevent narcolepsy, but treatment can reduce the number of attacks and the symptoms. You know, for most people, lifestyle changes help a lot. You know, taking naps during the day, eating vegetarian meals, avoiding alcohol and other drugs. In addition, for more extreme cases, amphetamines and antidepressants were used to keep narcoleptics awake. But, you know, these are serious drugs, and there's a high risk that they're abused, and they often have serious side effects, such as anorexia, nervousness, irritability, inability to sleep at normal times. And so they're a little dangerous.
I also wanted to look at devices that narcoleptics currently use. And some of the ones I found are medical ID bands, which just tell people you have narcolepsy and these medical alert tags. And sort of what these products do is, like, I have a narcoleptic attack and you come up on me. You know what I mean? You don't need to call the hospital because I'm going to wake up. You just sit with me, you know, call an emergency call on my phone. Everything's going to be okay. And those are really useful once you've had your attack. But if you're in a car and you're driving, or you're Omar and you're trying to study up late at night, you need something to keep you awake, you know what I mean, or to help you get into a safer position where you can pull over and then take a nap and wake up in an hour and a half or so. And so I thought about various stimuli that could be used to help people with narcolepsy stay awake. And so I thought about horns, I thought about vibrations, I thought about light therapy, because there's a lot of research that goes behind using lights to change people's circadian rhythms to keep them awake. I thought about, you know, would I want this to be a one-package device? Do I want it to be attached to a headset, separate? And a huge problem I had was, you know, how do I connect this headset that NeuroSky has, you know, to something that can bring about this? And I spoke with, you know, the electrical consultants in room 36, and I'm a human biology major, and so this makes about as much sense to me as I think it makes to most of you. So that's a feasibility issue that I'm dealing with. But there are really simple ways to bring about paths, like simple motors. And so going through it, I've decided to use this MindWave Mobile that NeuroSky provided and connect it to an Arduino via a Bluetooth shield. For those of you that don't know, an Arduino is like a miniature computer. So you can feed it simple tasks and have it do simple things as well. For example, from speaking with the narcolepsy and sleep centers on campus, we found out that your EEG changes in measurable ways when you're falling asleep. Your alpha power of your brainwaves decreases. You transition from high-frequency EEG to low-frequency EEG. So this is something that the MindWave Mobile can read, communicate to the Arduino, and the Arduino can then vibrate and hopefully wake the person with narcolepsy up. The total cost right now is steep. The products that I'm using, the MindWave Mobile is $100, the Arduino is about $30, the Bluetooth Shield is $35, and the vibration motors came to $990. But I think those numbers can be dropped in various places. My overall goal is to produce a headset that can detect when a user is sleeping or is falling asleep and wake them up and help them get into a better, more comfortable, or safer place. I need to do user interviews. I need to prototype. I need to get the device on users. I need to re-prototype and find a way to aesthetically make it pleasing, because narcolepsy is an invisible disease, and we don't want to have people with narcolepsy being stigmatized, or else they won't use it. And by week 10, I want to complete my final project. So, went through a lot of information super quickly. Do any of you guys have any questions that I can answer?
You mentioned that when you normally measure the high-frequency disease, that's going to transition slowly, and how will your answer be able to figure out what's going on, so, or is it quicker in terms
of... So I think it's a very abrupt transition between high-frequency and low-frequency. In addition, the MindWave Mobile also has an eye blink counter. So I've been thinking about observing the change in frequency and blinks to try to anticipate when somebody's about to fall asleep. Okay. Thank you guys very much.
I'm Matt, senior in ME. Tommy is senior in BME.
And Will, senior in tech. I'm going to track. So, according to a study done last year, 89% of people over the age of 50 would like to work on their own long muscle. Not a surprising fact. But one key aspect of being able to age in place is being able to move around the environment you live in. And a factor that, or a variety of factors make this hardest for you age. And this includes pains and aches, walking devices, and wheelchairs, along with other mobility impairments. So our goal is to create a device that addresses this problem and allows people to age in place. And some requirements we have for this device must be economical, aesthetically pleasing, easy to use, and space conscious. So essentially, the crux of what we're trying to solve, eliminate small sets of steps and flatten out of house. Here's some stats. So as you can see, over a grand majority of houses in the United States are over one story. And by the year 2030, over 20% of people will be 65 and over. There are 19 million people report trouble climbing stairs. 7 million people use mobility assist devices. And there are 12,000 deaths a year due to stairs. So as you can see, the need for this kind of solution is great and growing. We have two interviews. We talked with Jeff, who is the CEO of Levant. He is the project sponsor. He talked about technologies that exist and noted that there really aren't that many. And so from us, he wanted something novel that he had to support to address the problem. He is very excited about that he has an exoskeleton, but we decided that that was outside of the scope of this class. And he's a good source for us for links and articles pertaining to this issue.
And so we also spoke with Morgan, who came and talked a couple weeks ago. She lives in the same house that I do. And I asked her how important this problem was for her on campus. And what she said was, in academic places, it wasn't as much of a problem as it was in residences, especially grow houses. And what she felt was that the social aspect of life for people with disabilities was kind of not given as much credit as it should. And so especially like lounges and kitchens often have like one step, especially in Xanadu and Bob and Kafka, the three main houses in the row, all have lounges that are something down. And when she's there for like a classroom and a meeting in the lounge, she can't really participate. And so I showed her some of the different design concepts we were considering, and she was really against anything attached to her chair, anything like a stair climber or an exoskeleton that would yell disability any more than her wheelchair. And so we decided to do something really discreet and efficient after that conversation.
Yeah, so we also spoke to Lynette Evans, who runs A Friendly House, a blog looking at universally designed homes, and she had some excellent advice on how they go about remodeling and doing new construction to deal with transitions, which are these height differences within houses, and some problems related to universal design, and the fact that people don't always want to admit that they are needing these devices, and so not to make their house seem like a hospital or very different than what it was before. So we kind of narrowed down our statement of need a little bit to say that people with mobility impairments need to be able to safely navigate houses with these non-obvious to many people steps and sets of steps, which fell into about three categories: these just lips, single steps, and then sets of steps all the way up to a staircase. Here's an example of one, just a picture we pulled up. Obviously the people constructing the house didn't see any problem with having a step between the two rooms, but the new residents really was a problem for them. So some existing solutions to these problems, and it's very varied. Traditionally ramps, anything from custom-built wood ramps to single aluminum ramps, solution not very space conscious at the moment. There are lifts, mostly used in commercial situations, but there are also residential versions, very expensive and troublesome many times. There are stair aids, which decrease the height of the stairs, cut it in half to assist people. Wheelchair assists, these like tank robots that you attach to the wheelchair to help you up, very complicated, as well as the climbing wheelchairs, which are either just meant for a step or two or are extremely expensive and self-balancing. Then, of course, there's the exoskeleton, which could also promise some opportunities for helping people up the stairs in some years from now. So talking about some of the designs we looked at, kind of broke down into stuff that's based on the environment, stuff that's modular portable, and stuff that's based on the mobility device. So some of the environmental ones were deployable ramps that slide out from the stairs, pneumatic assist platforms on the stairs, and then various variations on the ramp itself. Then some of the portable stuff is like deployable ramps from wheelchairs, and then these small triangular prism ramps that help you get up single steps. And then stuff related strictly to the wheelchair, some redesigns of the actual wheel structure to help with a single or a few multiple steps.
And so after brainstorming, we sort of came up with the guidelines we would use to decide which would really be the best option. And the first thing we need to consider was what type of user we were trying to address. For example, Morgan spends most of her time in a scooter, in an electric wheelchair. And so some of the modifications to wheelchair designs that we had, such as the spokes that require a lot more upper body strength, were sort of out of the question for her. We also considered whether it be permanent, modular, or fixed to another device. And since our original problem statement was retrofitting a house, a one-story house, we decided we want something that's either modular or able to be added on. And so our final considerations were set up time, ease of use, aesthetics, and the cost. And so our prototype right now, we don't have a physical prototype, but this is a
rendering
on SolidWorks of a modular, low-cost. It says aesthetically pleasing ramp, although it may not look that way. But we have some ideas about how to make things like the grip tape and the blending into the environment better.
Demonstrating.
Yeah, some other demonstrations of our ramp. And so moving forward, we'll need to do some more physical prototyping and brainstorming, testing out with users, and finally deciding what kind of materials and manufacturing process we use. Thank you.
So the rendering that we showed you would be something to replace kind of the wooden ramps and aluminum ramps for homes, but the idea with the modularity and the construction methods would be to also be able to make something that is like that singular triangular prism, extremely lightweight, and that you could just put for a single step and carry with you, supposedly on a wheelchair.
You could have it permanently installed.
That too, yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the structural supports, just essentially. The current thoughts are kind of thermoformed plastics for cost and aesthetics, and so, yeah, just a theoretical prototype support structure.
Last but not least.
Of those 800,000, 800,
88% will develop hemiplegia, which is the paralysis of one half of the body.
Hemiplegia is very debilitating to everyday life. It affects your eating,
speaking,
walking,
cooking,
understanding others,
paying bills,
depression,
and getting dressed.
So why do people wear socks? Everybody wears socks, right? But it's not something we ever think about. There's lots of, you know, reasons. Most of them is really just, you know, preventing sweaty feet and making sure your shoes fit all right. You know, style, comfort, and improving circulation.
Socks come in all sorts of different shapes and sizes.
On one end of the spectrum, a lot of people who are aging have blood pooling in the legs. So they need what's called compression socks, which are essentially just socks that are a whole lot tighter, that help blood return through the veins to the heart. On the other end of the spectrum, there are diabetic socks, which are just the opposite. They're extra loose, so they don't constrict blood vessels. So someone who is a diabetic can have better circulation in their legs. And not everyone wears these crazy exotic woolen socks. These are two sock darning aids that are currently on the market that we have here today. They're kind of the best on the market for someone who has hemiplegia. However, they have some serious limitations. One being, it's very hard to actually get the sock onto the device in the first place if, you know, you only have really one good hand to do that. The second limitation is that the success rate of actually using the device is pretty low, and we've played with this for weeks and weeks, and most of the time we just get the sock on like half of our foot, and I was like, okay, well, what do I do now? You got to take it off and kind of start back from the beginning, and these are really the only options on the market today.
So we conducted a few interviews. We talked with Deborah Kenny, who is an occupational therapist over at the Stanford Medical Center. A few valuable things we learned from Debbie was, one, really what the limitations are of having hemiplegia. We're talking about individuals who often can't bend more than 90 degrees at their waist. They can't cross their legs, and they don't have control over half of their body. And on top of that, Debbie made a very important point, which is that it's essential for this particular design. It's very simple because associated with stroke is often some level of mental disability for a period of time. So it's important to have a device that's intuitive to the user. And when they look at it, it makes sense to them how it is that you use it. We also interviewed Jackie, who is one of Debbie's students. He had a stroke several years ago, and he's since been recovering. And the lesson we really learned from Jackie is that hemiplegia is not a uniform condition. For example, Jackie has partial use over some of his limbs, and those are sort of things that he's been working on for years. So while Jackie has learned adaptive methods to be able to put on his socks, there's still many users that we need to address his problem of.
Great, so now we're going to walk you through some of the ideas that we've had, as well as the ones that are currently on the market. We've got the two that we brought today. They're not very good in terms of utility, and ease of use, they're equally poor. So let's start with something we like to call the claw idea.
So the basic idea behind the claws is sort of a similar function to your basic claw grabber that you could buy at a supermarket. And so you'll have basically the outside claw is this claw, the one that is already on the device, and then it'd be modified with an inner claw, which you'd fold the sock over, and then from the non-hemiplegic half, the upper body, the user could, after folding the sock over the inner claw, they could compress this. It'd be a toggle, it wouldn't be analog like it is now, and that would grip the sock on, and then they could flip their foot into the sock and release the toggle and move the device with their sock on.
A modification of the claw design would be one where instead of having two loops, it would have two tabs that really you position the sock on one side, you close the tab. You position the sock on the second side, you close the tab. similar design principle. We have the bed cloth that aids the sock onto the foot. And once the sock is there, you can release the claw to let go of the tab to be able to reboot the device.
Another idea we have is a big modification on the device that we bought, which is really just a kind of a half pipe. It's very simple. We're going to introduce a hinge along the spine. We're going to kind of cut these edges so that they're a lot smoother, easier to put the sock on. That's the whole point. And finally, we're going to add a kind of a no-slip grip piece of tape. And the whole point of that is to keep the sock on the device while you're trying to slide it up your leg. Also, we're thinking about putting some, maybe a rigid bars instead of the rope, so it's more a whole lot easier to maneuver it while it's on the ground.
This is one of our original designs, which is it's a boot, and you would fold the sock over the top of the boot and clip it on somehow, and you can put your foot in just like you put it into a shoe, and then unhinge it back and move your foot away. So we want to explore different materials, especially for these half-pipe designs, which have to be flexible but also, you know, stiff enough to hold their shape and hold the sock on. We're going to have to do several prototype iterations to explore the functionality of all these different devices, and also ergonomic shapes and geometries are going to be important for ease of use.
All right, thank you very much.
Seems like you've got three different approaches that you're going to be taking. Have you decided which one you're going to be working on in the weeks to come?
I think we can sort of take it in parallel with modifying this device and developing our cloth.
Yeah, kind of two branches of a tree of ideas. The claw ideas, whether like a double claw that grips, or the tabs, or something along the lines of what's already on the market. And big modifications to it.
Yeah. So this would be more of the long shot idea. Not to say it's a long shot necessarily, but this would be, you know, the harder idea we're going for, and then we could always fall back on some sort of modification of the current device.
If you prototype rapidly, you'd be able to find out if that's going to work or not.
Yeah, we're going to start prototyping rapidly.
Anything else? Thank you very much.
Well, I want to thank all the students for their great presentations, and I want to thank everybody who's evaluated them. You did such a good job. When you hand in your evaluations, you can take a cookie as you leave. So have a great weekend, everybody, and please mark down any ideas or comments you have on this process. And as I mentioned, the results will be distributed to the students. Thanks again.